My coin.
So that's all life is to you? Monsters and money?
It's all it needs to be.
But there is a vortex of fate around all of us, Geralt. Growing with each and every one of our choices. Drawing our destinies in closer.
Welcome to Kin Folklore, a podcast where we explore fictional worlds that bring people together. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul, and we're cousins who love to talk about world building and sci-fi and fantasy. We hope that over time, through our shared love of our favorite stories, we all become family on this podcast journey.
For our second season, we will be discussing The Witcher, the epic fantasy show by Netflix. Today, we're going to talk about the major plot points in episode 3, titled Betrayer's Moon, and give you our reflections on the show and some takeaways that will help you navigate this world.
In addition, it's important to note that Kin Folklore contains adult content, much like the show The Witcher contains adult content. So if you don't enjoy commentary about a sweaty romp in a brothel, this may not be the podcast for you. So tip your bard and control your chaos. This is episode 3. So we're going to get into this summary, and it starts out, a dying boy speaks of a tale about a pregnant maiden who died before her time and her babe became a monster. Another witcher, not Geralt of Rivia, is paid to pursue the monster. He arrives at the scene where the boy was harmed, a butcher larder, and is attacked by the beast. We do not see the beast, but the beast moves super quickly and makes short work of the witcher.
Destroys him. Yeah. Just weak Witcher game here. Weak.
This guy didn't seem prepared at all. It's like he walked in there not expecting a monster.
He's like, let me take all your money and literally just look around.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, he is not ready for what this monster is bringing, and we wonder why. He went in there, he got a lot of coin too, right? So it's pretty crazy. Anyway, meanwhile, Geralt is in a tavern inn having some fun with a local sex worker. Get it in. Yeah. All right, Geralt, here we go.
A lot of sex in this episode.
A lot of sex. It was good. I loved it. She is trying to identify his scars based on the bard's tale. So we know that the bard's been singing up a storm, getting that good promo out, and now she wants to know, well, what is this? What is that? She finds a scar she can't identify, and Geralt says it's from a princess.
That was Renfrey, right?
Yeah, Renfrey put that knife in his leg, for sure.
I wasn't 100% sure, but I assumed it was from Renfrey.
Yeah, Renfrey did that before he finally had to kill her. So Geralt's friend in the brothel mentions another witcher who was there too and paid her on his way to Temeria, and he never returned. Intrigued by the mention of the other witcher, Geralt heads to Temeria, but not before he's encountered by the impatient pimp knocking on the door.
Okay, I don't know if he would like to be called a pimp, all right? He's the innkeeper. Why are we only giving him a pimp? Yes,
because he's like seriously cock-blocking.
Money for both the woman and for the room, but
the very definition of a pimp is he's hanging out here with Frankie Mermaid, okay? Like, that's what's going on. He's swimming in the bitches, okay? This is what's happening.
So few of our listeners are gonna get that Frankie Mermaid. But I knew that the Velocipastor was gonna somehow make its way into Kin Folklore.
Yeah, if you are not into the Velocipastor yet, do yourself a favor. Go watch that, okay? High cinema. High cinema. All right? And he leaves Roach, by the way, after he's done and they're all hanging out. He leaves Roach with the innkeeper because he went into this brothel, hooked up with the sex worker, and didn't have the money, no coin, to pay. What do you think was going to happen? He was going to pay on his good looks? It's her job. What's wrong with this guy?
He really does seem like he was just gonna go there, have his fun, and then bounce.
He's like, yeah, I'm the, you know who I am, right? I'm the Witcher. You know, you may have heard of me. The bar's been singing some songs, you know? Like, get out of here, bro. Like, where's your coin? That's what I want to know.
I mean, he did pay her. He just didn't pay for the room.
The inn. Yeah, he didn't pay for the inn. Yeah. Okay. All right, fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough.
No, because she, when he gives her the money, she's like, but what about the room?
No plan. No plan like our boy, the first Witcher, who had no plan for the monster. Anyway, meanwhile, in Temeria, the miners who paid for the previous Witcher are skeptical of Geralt because they have already been swindled. They think that the beast is a Volkadak, a werewolf-type monster. Because the king has done nothing, they are planning a rebellion. Their little chit-chat is broken up by one of the king's men. Geralt is swiftly kicked out. On his way out of town, he is visited by a mage by the name of Triss Merigold, who intercepts him and says that she wants the Witcher to help her save the creature. Triss Merigold reveals that the previous Witcher was killed by the beast. Geralt examines the body and determines that Astriga made the wounds. He tells Triss that Astriga can only be made through a curse. They deduce that Princess Ada's daughter is the Striga.
Can we just, before you move on, I just want to say, there's a lot of fake news in this kingdom, okay?
Yeah.
Triss Merigold and the king were out here telling people that the other Witcher just bounced with their money, as opposed to just being like, hey, we're in trouble. Even a Witcher can't take on this beast.
Yeah.
Hide your kids, hide your wife, get out of there, because we're in trouble.
I love that. Oh my God. Yes, hide your wife and hide your kids. Yo, listen, that Striga did short work of the Witcher, and nobody knew that the coin was there because the coin is just still there. Like, you know? It's hilarious. Yeah, so no, a lot of fake news in the kingdom. I'm glad that Geralt is there to get to the bottom of it. And in the next scene, we go to Born Hogwarts once again. And in that scene, Yennefer and Istrid take their relationship to the next level in front of an audience. Yennefer has conjured my boy Istrid, having a little performance anxiety, trying to get her to get rid of the crowd, but she's having none of it. They fantasize about their future plans after climax. And Yennefer says that she doesn't see her idealized self as well as the others. She says that she never wants to be that scared girl that portaled to him when they first met. She meets with the man who is going to do her transformation. He's basically like, you know, L.A. plastic surgeon, magical powers, doing his thing. Going to make sure that everything comes out the way that he envisions you. It's a weird, weird situation. Not really sure what's going on here. And tells him that she is bound for Aiden. Tasaya tells Yennefer that mages remake themselves on their own terms and she can free herself from the girl in the mirror forever. A really beautiful scene where we don't actually see what Yennefer sees in the mirror, but Tasaya like looks at her and then says she's beautiful, meaning that Yennefer is kind of visualizing her idealized self. And I don't think that Tasaya's take on it, I'm just going to say, was outside beauty alone. I think she was looking at the powers that Yennefer has. I think Tasaya's always seen something special in Yennefer.
Yeah, I think that Tasaya definitely values Yennefer's ability over the way she looks. But, you know, she's also sent her mixed messages by calling her Piglet, telling her, you know, that in the first episode that we saw her in, which was last week, basically that it doesn't matter, you know, nobody's ever going to value her. So they have a very mixed relationship, but Tasaya is definitely coming around to, you know, a deep connection with Yennefer.
Yeah, she met Piglet in like the nicest way. Like however you can nicely meet Piglet. No, I'm joking. Not at all. Oh my goodness.
Let's go with that. Okay, sure. I just feel like in their beginning, you know, here at fake, boring Hogwarts, she's kind of like a little Snape-y. A little like our boy Snape.
Yeah, if they sorted, piece of crap school. If they sorted, we'd know what house she was in, but she's not. She's not a Slytherin because they don't sort. They're not so cool like that.
I mean,
anyway.
Everyone in this world is a Slytherin, probably, but
I don't know. Istrid has a lot of puff tendencies. Mm. Istrid is kind of, but I hear that's not the case later on in the story. So I will leave that alone. You're right. He's probably Slytherin too. Never mind. I take that back.
You know, I think our fans should go ahead and just sort the characters and report back. And if you want to do that, we will read out the sorting on the podcast.
Oh my God. What a good idea. Yes, please. Let's sort all the characters. Geralt, Tasaya, Istrid, Yennefer. I love it.
Yeah, I think that would be fun to do.
That'd be fun.
So going back to Geralt's story, Triss takes him to the king, King Foltes, and Geralt, in a very undiplomatic way, accuses the king of committing an incestuous act with his sister and fathering the Striga.
Geralt, you know, let's get to the point here. Listen, I think I know what's going on. He slams the door. He's like, yo, I think I know what's going on here. Yeah. I think you were boning your sister. I think that's what was happening.
Not a great look. It's rough. Like, Geralt just, like, he's too direct sometimes. Sometimes I want him to have a little diplomacy. I mean, he could have smooth talked this a little bit.
Smooth talk is not in his vocabulary. Like, even his pillow talk was lame. He's got a weak pillow talk game. Yeah.
And then he tells her that she's like, weren't you listening to me? And he's like, you should know when someone's faking it. He's so mean. Okay, oh my gosh. All right. Back on track here. So back at Arethusa, the chapter of the Brotherhood, which is basically like a small group of mages who oversee the placement of mages into each kingdom, they meet because they're placing the upcoming initiates. And after some harsh politicking, they decide that Yennefer should go to Nilfgaard rather than Frangilla. And can I just say, this was really a hard scene for my girlfriend, Jilla, because they're just dunking on her in front of her uncle. Just like, she's not super smart. Don't send her to Nilfgaard. It's going to be more difficult. We need to send someone of a little bit more backbone. It was not great.
Oh yeah, no, serious dunking. It was pretty. It was actually pretty great. I actually enjoyed it because I don't really like her that much, so it was actually good for me. I was like, yes.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I felt bad for Frangilla just because even her uncle is like, yeah, you're right. It's like not super nice. So when Yennefer gets the news that she's gonna go to Nilfgaard, she gets really upset and she goes to confront Tasaya, and Tasaya tells her that basically it was because she has elven blood in her. And Yennefer deduces that it was Isred who told Stregobor her secret, and that's how they figured out that her father was part elf.
Oh, but not before she dunks on Tasaya. She's like, oh, the powerful Tasaya. Like, she's pulled from her glass pedestal. She can't do anything. She got told what was going to happen. You didn't dictate anything. She tried, because, you know, Tasaya tried to, like, play it like she made the choice.
Yeah.
Yeah, please.
Everyone's so mean to everyone else in this episode. I was like, everyone's just mean and harsh and direct. A little like grace here, folks.
That's what happens when you're bored. That place is so boring. So boring. You just start lashing out. You're just so bored. Anyway.
When we go back to Geralt, he obviously doesn't care about the rules. After the king has basically thrown him out, he's standing outside of the castle and Triss finds him there. They break into the castle together and they confirm the incestuous relationship between the king and the princess Adda, his sister who passed away. Geralt figures out that the king's advisor, a knight named Ostret, was jealous and cursed the princess's pregnancy. Rather than attend her initiation, Yennefer goes to pick a fight with her boyfriend. He apologizes and tells her basically, like, she's missed the initiation, but she can come with him wherever he goes. He's been given, it seems like a pretty important task to do research. And she refuses and says some pretty nasty stuff to him.
Because he's feeling himself a little too tough. You could come with me. And he's basically essentially saying, I know you're this powerful mage, but why don't you just go ahead and be a housewife to me, and I'll just go ahead and do everything, and you can just stay at home. And she's like, no, dude, you're playing yourself right now. Do you not know who I am? No, I'm not going to follow you around, trips around while you do your research. And she throws out his school and everything. She's like, a Barnard boy would think that, because she's pissed at him and Stregobor and everything that they stand for. And I don't blame her. I'm not mad at her at that. She should have dunked.
I'm not mad at her for how she feels in this moment, and I'm not mad at him. But the things they say to each other, I'm like, these two would have never. If you truly love someone, the things that they say, you wouldn't. They basically just take this opportunity to pull each other down and reduce each other to the worst parts of themselves. And I was like, man, you guys really fight with knives out. Yennefer brought a grenade to a knife fight. She just was not having it.
Yo, but she pulls his card too, right? Did you peep out in the scene when he's saying all this stuff? He's going off of what he's seen in her mind, because he's been reading her mind. And she says, would it, devastate you to know you're not privy to all my thoughts? And then he realizes, oh, you're placating me, and states that. And then he, in that moment, he realizes that she's been reflecting back his thoughts to him as a way of stopping him from being able to read her thoughts. And he realizes that the jig is up. She's not for these fucking games. She's actually been playing him the whole time while he thought he was playing her.
Oh, totally. Yeah. They were both manipulating each other and using magic to do so. It's fairly gross.
Yeah.
So Yennefer goes back to the magical plastic surgeon and basically tells him, do this transformation now. He protests a little bit, but he's intrigued. He's like, all right, this girl's for real. And we see that the price that she has to pay for the transformation is pretty great. She basically has to sacrifice her womb, so she'll never be able to have children. She arrives at the ball completely transformed and charms her way into the appointment that she wanted, which was in her home kingdom. And can I just say that king is garbage also for the way that he treated Frangilla?
Oh my gosh, it's so good though. I mean, Frangilla is trash. She doesn't freaking, she turned her hand into a shriveled up something in the beginning. She's already been remarked that she's not that great at a lot of other magical things, and she's probably that. She comes out really strong at the end. We're not going to spoil it, but I know she comes up. She has a come up, but in this point, she's kind of she's not so great. Not so great.
Yeah, I have to say, Frangilla had a tough episode. just dunking on her left and right. Poor Frangilla. Also in this scene can we just take a moment? I want to give the credit to your fiance where it's due.
Yeah.
They are having a fake Yule ball here. Yeah. at Boring Hogwarts. It is terrible. The Yule ball at Hogwarts is much better. This is awful.
It is like the worst interpretation. It's like they went over and took notes from Hogwarts and were like, Dumbledore, how do you guys entertain your students? And then they went back and did the boring version. You know what I mean? It was yes, let's do that. Let's do that, but boring.
Yeah. It's the ball was kind of a mess.
It was a mess. Total mess.
Whew. All right. So back in the whole situation with the Striga, Geralt captures Osric, the knight who cursed the princess, and he gets a lot of information out of him, basically how the curse was performed, and then he just uses him as bait for the Striga. We'll get into some more detail about the background on the Striga later in the episode. Geralt drinks a potion, and he fights the Striga after it murders Osric, and it basically takes out all of his entrails. It's really gross the way
just guts him.
Yeah,
it just guts him. It couldn't happen to a nicer guy though.
It was pretty disgusting. So the way that the fight is pretty prolonged, and it's actually really cool. This show can be a little bit iffy with the effects sometimes, but I thought they did a great job with this. But the way that Geralt basically wins is that he goes into the crypt with the mother's corpse rather than letting the Striga return to the crypt. So once the sun comes up, she transforms back into a princess. This scene of her transformation and Yennefer's transformation are intercut together. And it's really, really difficult to watch both of them screaming and suffering and transforming into something that's basically more palatable for others. Geralt is injured when he approaches the now transformed Striga, who is a teenage girl. And she is still kind of a Striga because she still has long nails and claws and basically attacks him.
Sharp teeth?
Yeah, she attacks him. He's injured pretty badly, but not fatally. And Triss is able to nurse him back to health. And she basically tells him in that conversation that there's more out there for him. The episode closes on this scene with Ciri, who we haven't seen the whole episode. And I kind of didn't notice. I don't find Ciri super interesting, but
yeah.
I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot about Cirilla. The episode goes on Ciri waking up in a forest, and she starts to hear voices calling to her, and she follows the sound. Dara tries to stop her, but as he's running towards her, arrows are being shot at him, and eventually he's struck by one. And Ciri appears to be in a trance, and that's how the show closes. She's at the edge of the forest with these voices calling to her, and Dara calling to her from the other end, don't go. And she seems like she's only hearing the voices.
I'm going to need my boy Dara to stop catching bad ones for Ciri out here. Like, he is catching too many bad ones out here for her.
Yeah, she's honestly, I mean, I know he's a good guy, but I'm kind of like, she's not really worth it at this point. Like, obviously to the story, she's worth it. She's very important to the story. But I'm like, why are you going through all of this for her?
Yeah.
Like, she's, I mean, not great.
Amazing vocal range, trash person so far, not so great. No, she's not trash. Let me not say that. She has some redeeming qualities.
No, she's, I think Cirilla is actually quite sweet. She's just very naive, you know. She's,
naive
she's
is the right word.
She's extremely privileged and naive. And so the world is cruel to a lot of the folks outside of the castle, right? But she hasn't experienced that. So I think she's a sweet girl, though.
But sings magically. Magical vocal
range. Okay, why are you doing it? You really just want to have the Ariana Grande stands in our Twitter. Let's not do it.
Oh, man. I am so here for that. I am so here for that. At me, please. It's okay. It's all right. I'm here for it. So, you know, there's some things to cover here. Lots of things going on here. Do we want to talk? Let's talk about kind of that transformation scene, and you know, we kind of talked offline a little bit about it, and I think it is a tough scene to watch. Like, when Yennefer screams and the fire just is like almost looks as if she's breathing fire, and then you see also the Striga like going through something similar in that moment, and it's like even the audio, you're hearing both their screams on the different scenes overlap.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because, I mean, it's obviously not happening in the same time period. So, but the editors are mirroring this in a way that's making a statement.
Yeah, I mean, we have two women here who are suffering basically because of the way that the world has set their lives, right? So, like, Yennefer believes that she has this belief about beauty and power, and to be acceptable to others, she must be beautiful. And then we have this young princess who knows nothing of the world, but like she is essentially a monster that was created through another man's jealousy rather than punish the person he was actually angry at, which was the king. He punished and cursed the queen who rebuked his advances. So I think that these two women going through this transformation at the same time is very intentionally juxtaposed together, but also like it was really, really hard to watch. There, mm-hmm. and then they both land in this fetal position. And I had this, I just had a lot of feelings about what was trying to be said here. The Striga was a monster who's now transformed into a princess. Yennefer was not a monster. who is transformed into something that is more socially acceptable and would be more acceptable at court. And I don't think that that's necessarily the type of transformation she would have undergone at Taseya's request. I think that this was a very radical transformation. This was more probably even than Taseya had planned. So it's a tough scene for sure. And there's a lot of, they're trying to say a lot here. There's a lot of metaphors, but I really struggled with what were they trying to say about Yennefer and putting her transformation with another woman character who is essentially a monster, who's literally killing people, you know? So those were my thoughts about it.
Yeah, I think one of the takeaways I had from it, first addressing, like, talking a little bit about, like, the whole thing about Taseya, and it's very clearly stated in all the things I've read and also, like, on the Netflix, like, you know, explanation of the site, that this would have been a, like, really, really unsupported act that this magical plastic surgeon, as we're calling him, would have done. That he probably would have been expelled from the school, never to return. His job is really just to help with, like, enchantments and things like that so that the mages can go on to their duties that they've already been assigned to. And this was way beyond anything that to say or any of the people who were in charge of the Brotherhood would have said that they wanted done. I think the other half of what I thought about it, though, too, was in line with everything you're saying. I thought that one of the things that, you know, I used to love once, the ABC story that was, like, about all the fantasy worlds, and Rumpelstiltskin's character used to always say all magic has a price. And I thought that one of the things that was being illustrated here was the price, the cost of, like, what it means to, like, be so after power that it costs something. Like, the guy who was the knight in the other world who wanted something, the love of the princess, so bad that he was willing to enlist magic to try to, like, punish somebody. And the cost that it had was tons of people's lives and all of the things that came along with the curse that he brought upon the city and the town that he's from. And then there's also this cost that's going to cost this guy who's doing the actual surgery his position in the school. It's going to cost Yennefer a portion of herself that she doesn't even think. The only thing that's going to remain is her eyes and her scars and this quest for power that she, and like you said, the confusion around what power and beauty and those dynamics mean, because nobody was going to ask this of her. It's just her own desire to have something that she thinks is what she wants when in actuality it wasn't. I think it's keeping it 100. It's like we said offline, it's a dude who wrote this to make it about her having children. And so that part feels a little bit forced. And I don't think that was the cost that needed to be portrayed. But I think the point of the cost being of power and the lust of power being something when you're using magic or outside forces is very well done in the cross cutting of these two scenes, you know?
Yeah. I totally agree. I wish Yennefer is such a great character. I really struggled with this transformation. Not so much the scene, because I thought that the scene was really powerful, but then once it was over and I thought about it, I really struggled with it. So I love her character, but I have some feelings about what they were trying to say about what the cost was for her.
Well, let's talk about the cost. We're going to go a little bit into the story around the Striga and give some of our listeners who have expressed, like, some confusion about what was going on, some backstory. So the story started off that shortly after Fortis' coronation, Ada became pregnant with Fortis' child. Ada was younger than Fortis, and they were always together, but no one expected anything to be sexual except maybe perhaps their mother, who was the queen. Ada's pregnancy was noticed in court pretty much right away, and Fortis began saying that he wanted to marry his sister. The court advisors, along with Ada's help, managed to dissuade Fortis from a quick wedding to his sister, and at that point, give her time to have the baby. Ada gave birth, and only a few people were in the room when she bore the child. One midwife was said to have been so frightened that she jumped from the tower out of the window into her death, and the other midwife basically lost her mind and remains that way until this day, kind of in a daze. the baby was rumored to have died at birth along with Ada. Many people in the town and in the court believed that the child should have been burnt or buried in the woods. Instead, the king decided to put her to rest along with his wife in a sarcophagus beneath the palace. And for 7 years, there was no problem. There was peace. Nobody thought anything about it. Then one night, there were screams and commotion. And as you can guess, the infant had grown in the coffin and became the Striga that we see in the episode. Fortis summoned sorcerers because he was trying to fix the problem and figure out how he could deal with the problem of the Striga. And none of them could come to an agreement about what the proper course was, except for one wizard who argued that this was obviously magic and that all that would need to be done to break the spell would be that someone would have to stay overnight in the crypt with the Striga, and that would turn Fortis's daughter back into his daughter. So many thought that that wasn't true, but the sorcerer wanted to prove that he was right. So he went in to try to stop, to go ahead and, you know, work out his theory. And in that moment, he was also killed, leaving behind not much of the sorcerer except for his staff and his hat, which I found is a funny little detail. So the sorcerer, you know, Fortis heard this counsel and he stuck to it. He clung to it. He did not want to let go the fact that this could be reversed. So he forbade anyone to make an attempt to kill the Striga in the hopes that someone would be able to reverse the spell. And throughout all of this, Fortis only hinted with his court of marriage, still holding deep feelings for his sister. And he never ended up getting married, fully obsessed with the idea of reversing the spell of his daughter and turning her from the Striga back to the princess. And so he would constantly send out word for rewards to anyone who could accomplish this reversal. So enter our boy Geralt, who shows up and we see the events of the show. Some things that are important to note about all of this is that the Striga was 14 at the time, and even though she was 14, she had immense strength and moves, probably beyond what a Striga or a normal animal of that size would have at that moment. She only ventured out during the full moon, never came out during the day. After she was cured, it was going to be important for the princess to wear a sapphire and silver chain with an inclusion. And the inclusion was a little bubble inside of the sapphire that would have an enchantment. So for her to be able to not turn back into the Striga, that would be necessary for her to wear, along with burning different incenses in her room to make sure that she didn't go back and revert back to being the monster. When we see in the episode that the chains burn the Striga, it's because silver is fatal to most monsters that are created by magic in this world. So that's why Geralt looks and is like, oh, fuck, when like she breaks the chain after it's burning her, because he's realizing that she is stronger than most monsters, because most of the monsters in that world would have been contained by anything silver, especially a silver chain. And that would have been the end of the fight. There's also that part where he drinks a potion, and this is an important part about why he was able to defeat the Striga where other people have failed. So that potion was made up of herbs in this world, and it chiefly helps him to gain full control of his body. And anyone that's not a witcher or similar mutation as Geralt, those herbs would be poisonous. But because he is who he is, the mixture allows him to see the darkest places. And it also enhances his movements and reactions. So he was able to see clearer in that dark crypt. He was also able to move quicker in that crypt than what another witcher or another person would have. And the cast that he spells that kind of like repels the Striga during that is something that they call signs. And one of the signs is called the Sign of Ard. And this sign was used during the fight with the Striga, and it is comprised of a telekinetic thrust that can stun, repel, or knock down or disarm opponents, as well as remove barriers and objects. And so that's some of the things that you can kind of follow along to go back and watch again and maybe clarify some of the things based on those points.
Yes, thank you, because let me say, this show, I have no idea what the Witcher can do and can't do. They haven't done a good job of explaining what his actual abilities are, which is a little bit irritating, honestly, because it just seems like he can do whatever is needed in that moment. It's helpful to understand like what the potion was doing and what these signs mean. So That stuff is super helpful in context.
I was blown away by like the fact that they didn't cover the potion, because I've started to, as we said, we're doing this as a way to dig into the world more and to understand it more and to make it clear for all our friends, you know, as we find out what it is that, and listeners here, what it is that we're finding out about the world. And when I found out that the potion actually enhances ability to win that fight, that there was no dialogue or no explanation in the episode, actually, I think is a drawback. The only people who have read the book, or which I'm doing right now, currently in the process of, or have played the game, would have known that. And so it's something I think that they should, hopefully in season two, they'll get a handle on trying to explain some things a little bit deeper.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Okay. So I'll start out by talking about some of the exposition we heard about Nilfgaard. Most of this was in the conversation that the miners had. So they talk about the rebellion in which an old king was deposed for a usurper. Very important, that usurper is going to become the subject of an episode later. During Yennefer's story, it's also mentioned that the king of Nilfgaard is basically a philanderer who spends all of his money on women while his people are starving. And that's why they want to send Yennefer to Nilfgaard, because they think she'll be a more steady hand to make things right and guide the king back towards, taking care of his people rather than, you know, taking care of his urges.
Is Nilfgaard like another way of saying King's Landing in Westeros? Because I feel like this is like Robert Baratheon. Like, they're just like, hey, you know what? He's out here not caring about the kingdom, just sleeping with mad women. That's sounds like some bad moves there by the king. So he's going to... And then this is a good time to kind of talk about the timeline. Mm-hmm. Because when they're saying the things about Nilfgaard and what's going on with that king, you notice like earlier in the episode, we were discussing that the people over in the kingdom that the Striga's in basically are referencing the rebellion that happened in Nilfgaard to overthrow the king with a usurper. So it's important to note here that these two timelines, Yennefer's timeline and Geralt's timeline, are happening probably about 27 years apart. So for people who have been a little confused by the timeline, I just want to like kind of clarify that is what's happening, and that Prince Fulstice, you'll see, and Princess Adda are actually at the ball that we're talking about earlier. And the royal ceremony actually is happening in 1210, which they don't put anything behind the numbers in this world, which is interesting. It's just 1210. And Geralt's timeline is actually happening in 1237. So 27 years after the royal ceremony and after Yen's transformation is what is happening with the Striga. And so Nilfgaard is actually still being ruled in the time of Yen's storyline by this king. But by time we get to the place where the people are talking about the ruler being overthrown, it's actually he's been overthrown and there's a new ruler on that throne 27 years after.
Mm-hmm. So let's also just talk about where everything is. So I spent a little bit of time with the map that Netflix put out. So we're just going to talk about some of the larger landmarks and then also the places we've been so far. There's more that will at a later point we should probably touch on, but I don't want to confuse folks with all of the places in this story. So
you know what's funny? Every time we're getting ready to talk about this, we're getting ready to talk about the map. I cannot this is the price of having children. I just keep hearing the map song from Dora the Explorer. I just keep hearing it in my head. You know, there's a place you need to go. No, I'm the map. I'm like, come on, man. All right.
Now I'm having regrets. Maybe we should have recorded like our own little chant to go with the maps.
Maybe we will. Moving forward,
route. Interestingly enough, even though, as you just said, that the story takes place, the main portions of the story, we're not talking about series portion, which is very short, take place about almost 30 years apart, they actually happen in the same place almost. Temeria is a central kingdom. It is basically right in the middle of the map. And Aretuza is actually located in Temeria. It's, I believe that they have sort of like a deal where they're not really subject to that particular king, but their land is actually, the school is actually on Temerian land. The whole world, continent, we should say, because we're kind of restricted to this continent, but the world may be beyond just where we are right now. So the major natural borders are mountain ranges to the west and the Great Sea, which is to the east. In the north, there are what we call, what is called the Dragon Mountains, which we will visit in a later episode. To the west are the Blue Mountains and the Fiery Mountains and the Karaf Desert. Nilfgaard is the southernmost kingdom. It is to its east is the Great Sea, and to its west is the desert. But it has lots of varied resources because of this. And then Sintra, which is a kingdom that's also central, like Temeria, is coastal. So even though it's in the middle of the map, it's right on the Great Sea, which makes a lot of sense because Ciri's grandfather is like a great, known for being a seafarer. So those are the main places. Blaviken is more northern than most of the other places, but it's not super far from Temeria or Sintra. We're kind of, the story is kind of like centered on this more central part of the kingdom right now.
Yeah, no, great. I'm so glad you're explaining that. And it's interesting because I was looking at the map and I was seeing that. I was like, oh, wow, these places that they're mentioning make more sense. So I would highly suggest to our listeners, too, that are trying to get more into this world, the timeline on Netflix is pretty cool. And the map also there is really cool. And there's some other ones. I actually came across one in Reddit because, you know, this like mad Reddit sub threads in this joint. There was some good stuff in there too.
Yeah, so, I would highly recommend that folks look at the map and the timeline that goes with the map because it gives good explanations about the points in the story. It's not perfect, as Paul noted when we were prepping offline. There's a couple of errors.
We're going to talk about that. When you go and look at the map, as I looked at the map, there is an era. We should probably shout out at Netflix. There is a scene in the Brotherhood scene where they're talking about the king in Sintra and how Sintra has never allowed mages and they just don't believe in them. And they're saying, well, maybe they should try to do something to overthrow the king. And they're saying, well, but then Calanth will like take over and his daughter is a lot more difficult. It will be no easier than the king. But in the timeline on Netflix, Calanth is not born for another 6 years after that conversation. So something to note when you're going through the timeline that is a little bit of an error. Maybe the showrunners can explain it to us why that, how they would know what Calanth is going to be like. Maybe it's magical that they saw into the future, but she is not born for 6 years. It's all I can say based on their timeline.
Yeah. I was like pretty shocked when you raised that. I don't understand. What are you talking about? Of course she's not born on their timeline. So
yeah. Yeah, pretty well. But there's a lot of good stuff on there. Even with that mistake, I do encourage to read it because it has been super helpful to us as we've been getting deeper and deeper into this world. That along with, I also want to shout out as a person who's just started reading the books, pretty far into the first one. The book is so well written. Like, honestly, I didn't know how well written it was going to be. It's really, really good. Like, if you enjoy fantasy novels, there's things that like are in the show that you just see and just experience that he explains so well through his use of language, and the translation is probably helpful too. But it's just really, really well written. Anyway, so I encourage that too.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to read the books eventually. I just haven't. I'm like trying to catch up on my books that I didn't read last year.
Oh my gosh!
I'm still on my 2019 reading list, so I will get there eventually. But I'm excited. I've heard they're very well. So should we talk about what we loved, what we'd like to see more of, and what we questioned?
Yeah, let's do it. Why don't you start off?
So I think I already mentioned that I love the juxtaposition of Yennefer's transformation and the Striga's transformation back into a human princess. It was painful to watch, but I really like the way that it was edited together. What they're going through is something really difficult, so it should be painful to watch. But I thought that the editing was artful.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, I we've gone over that a little bit, so I won't belabor it. But yeah, it was really, really it was powerful. It was a powerful scene. And what I loved is Triss Merigold showing up. Triss Merigold, really, 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 really awesome. Also because she actually was Geralt's love interest at one point, and they introduce it in a way where it's not heavy-handed. And, you know, because we know the story is kind of going to focus a lot on Geralt and Yen and all that. But from some of the things I've read, there's kind of this weird love triangle between Yen and Geralt and Triss. And so to introduce that, that's really cool. I also love that she actually opens up Geralt to the idea that there's more than just monsters and coin. There's more than just doing your job and being a mutant, that there's actually a world that you should explore and things that you should think about beyond just like kind of being a curmudgeon going through the world with your horse and a bard singing about your exploits. There's other things. And I think she's hinting at love. I think she's hinting at like life experiences. And I think it's pretty powerful that it comes on the heels of him hearing in his head something about what was said to him about the girl in the forest, the girl in the woods. Mm-hmm. So that's all stuff I really love, that this introduction of another kind of like layer of his story through the eyes of Triss and what she represents in him and trying to like get him to see beyond like just being a witcher.
Yeah, I really like Triss too. She's mm-hmm. she's great. And she's she came at this with such a level of empathy and such mm-hmm. such determination, because the king isn't really listening. No one's listening to her, but she's determined yeah. to do what she knows is right, which is to save this girl from the fate of being a monster. So I like her too. She's a great character.
No shortage of good looking people in this world, by the way. No shortage. Like you got Isrid, you got Triss, you got Yen, you got Geralt. These guys, I mean, come on. Of course there was a lot of boning in this episode. It was bound to happen.
I mean, yes. The casting director, thank you.
Yeah, exactly.
You did an excellent job. These people are beautiful. All of them. Yeah. So thank you yes. for that.
Yes.
What would you like to see more of?
You know, I'd like to, I think we've hinted on it a little bit. I would like to see more of some of the backstory that will make this less of a mystery to the viewer. I think that it's cool that they're playing with not over-explaining, but I think they're under-explaining. And I would like to see, you know, when a guy pulls out a drink and does like says an incantation and then drinks it, and then a whole scene happens and we don't understand why his eyes are dilating until we read or what is going on, that's a hole in the storytelling, because I should be able to watch the story and not have to go back and read the books, although I'm going to as a fan. Like, I'm always going to go back and do more like digging, but the casual fan should be able to enjoy it much the same way the book reader does. And I think that is something that I'd like to see more of in the story. I'd like to see them kind of do what Thrones was able to do in, you know, at the risk of comparing them, because they're very different stories. Do what they were able to do like season 1 through 6, where it was, you didn't have to be a heavy book reader to follow along with the story. You could be a casual show watcher and still enjoy it.
Yeah, I think that I mostly agree. I do think that, I think I've said, I can't remember if I said this in the podcast or just to you, so I'm going to repeat it again. I think that they made a show that you have to watch multiple times to get a lot of the backstory. And so that's also what I would like to see. There was a lot of world building in this episode, but I didn't catch it on my first watch. And so the fact that this is a show you have to watch multiple times, I don't mind doing that, but I do wonder if that's what most people will do, or they'll just be confused.
Yeah, I agree.
I would love to see more of the history laid out explicitly, But I know that they're doing some of that already. I just don't think, I think it could be stronger. I think that there's a way that you can write it so that people don't need to necessarily watch an episode twice to catch all of it.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. So what did you question? What did you question about the episode?
I talked a little bit about this already. I actually really struggled with some of the Yennefer stuff. Because I've finished the series, I love Yennefer's character arc. She's the character who goes through the most growth. I think she's a great character. But I thought that the... I don't know. I don't know what they were trying to say with her transformation. The stuff about, you know, removing her disability, essentially, right? It doesn't feel great. It feels kind of icky. And it also, I just didn't feel like they made a strong case for why she's sort of conflating beauty with power here. The only other powerful woman that we've really seen closely in the show so far is Queen Calanthe, and she is powerful not because she's beautiful, but because she is a warrior. And I really struggled with what the message was supposed to be. I totally understand why there were people in the disability community who were upset about this. It's pretty disturbing that in fantasy I don't think it's disturbing. That's not the word I'm looking for. What I find disturbing is how these stories often land. So, in fantasy stories, you do tend to have more characters who have differences, be it a intellectual difference, a physical difference, and sometimes those differences are empowering. But I also have noticed a trend, and this is what I find disturbing, is that those characters are sometimes described in the text and subtext as being monstrous, as being deformed. And I think that in the world of fantasy and sci-fi, these are places where we don't have to bring the biases of our worlds. Of course, they're going to impact what you're writing because it's not written in a vacuum. But we can leave oftentimes gender dynamics, racism, cultural differences, and create new cultures and new biases and new conflicts. And so the fact that ableism kind of leeches into fantasy a lot more than some of the other biases really, really bothers me. And I struggled with this because Yennefer is an empowered character. She has a lot of agency, and I think that's great. She's literally magical, but she's not magical in a way that is exploitive based on her having a bent back, right? But I just think that we send certain messages to some of the audience when we literally put that next to someone transforming from a monster, you know? So I think the symbolism can be a little bit tough. But I do think I want characters who have disabilities to still be present and visible in fantasy. And I want women characters especially to still be present, visible, and have plenty of agency in fantasies. I just think that because of who writes a lot of the fantasies, it's not always done artfully.
Yeah, I hear that, and I agree. I guess what I took away from Yennefer's story, and this is why I had such a problem with it being the womb that was taken away as like you're not able to have children, is that I thought that the major takeaway that I had was that she was misguided, and that there was the world. Yes, the world was cruel to her. Yes, the world wasn't treating her as they should. But I almost look at it like Tyrion, to look at Game of Thrones again, where the world was cruel to him, but he found a way to like find the strength in his mind and sharpening it like a sword is to a whetstone. He used books, or he figured out a way to do it, and he became powerful in his own right. Arguably, obviously, we know how season 7 went, so let's just stop there. But he became powerful in his own right without having to change who he was, so to speak, which is the problem I have with them taking it and making it about her inability to have children. Because I think if we could have left it out, that out, and had her sacrifice something else, that it would have been a stronger statement about her choosing power over love, or choosing power over, like, you know, like community, or choosing power over fam, anything. But it was just so basic, and it seemed like this seemed like a guy's misguided viewpoint on his view of women. So I get that part of it.
What women are valued for, certainly.
So that's where I struggle with it. Is not so much that she chose to change herself. It's just and the transformation, but what the cost was of the transformation, because I think the bigger statement here is that power should not be your end all goal, right? That there's more to life than that. And I think that's what Triss is trying to say to The Witcher too. Like, hey, money should not be your end all goal. Survival, there's more to life than survival. And I think those points are being lost in some of, you know, what the writer is putting down. But I mean, there's still time for the story to develop. We're only in season one, and I've only read a portion of the first book, so I don't know where this goes, but that's my takeaway thus far.
Yeah, and I do think, I don't want to spoil, right? I know a lot of people have binged it already, but I also know that some people are watching it more slowly because they're a little confused. So I don't want to spoil, but yes, I do think that the theme about power comes across later. This was tough. Like, I think this episode and Yennefer's transformation, the decision she makes and how she talks, she kind of like conflates power and beauty. And I struggled with that. So my opinion on it is not, you know, any more important or less important than anyone else's. And I'm also very open to someone changing my mind about it. I'm still kind of processing, you know, like I'm still learning about this world, still trying to figure out how I feel about Yennefer, even though I really like her as a character. You know, it's not perfect, and no story ever is. So,
yeah, no. But it's a good takeaway. I like where you're going with that. I guess what I question is more and more is the storytelling, the round robin nature of the storytelling, the need for there to be no clear delineation between, you know, 27 years in the past and 27 years in the future. Why can't we just let the audience know that this is happening in different time periods so that we can keep the score? It's artfully done, no question. I guess it could take away from some of the cross-cutting between the two periods, and you could start thinking that there's some connection between the cross-cutting, which there isn't to our knowledge. But I do question it. I am starting more and more as I'm rewatching and seeing the timeline and seeing the way things are transforming, whether it's necessary, you know, whether it's absolutely necessary.
Yeah, so. I think some of it was necessary, but I think they kind of got a little bit too ahead of themselves with some of it. And next week, I think, is the episode where some of the timeline stuff starts to become a lot more clear. And I think we'll just remind everyone again and go through some of the major events in the timeline so that the stories feel more connective.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we have come to the end of episode 3. We are so grateful for you guys listening and being here with us. We're, you know, seeing your responses through listening and hitting us up, and you can do that on our Facebook page. You can go and leave reviews. Real important for us that you go and like review it on wherever you listen to podcasts, and also hit us up with your commentary, like on Twitter. You can go to KinFolklorePod or email us at kinfolklore@gmail.com. So we look forward to talking to you next week again.
All right. Thanks, everyone.